Hi, this is Lenny Pfeffer, President of the Dorchester County Council, welcoming you to the Maryland Association of Counties Conduit Street Podcast, the show that discusses the issues and ideas shaping Maryland policy and politics today.
Hello and welcome to the Conduit Street Podcast. This is Michael Sanderson. Joining me on the pod today is Sarah Sample from the MACO Policy Team. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks for having me today.
Well, I am happy to have you join, and we'll connect a few dots because what we want to talk about with this week's episode is sort of an interesting policy issue that has a lot of applications in the policy areas you work on and cover for MACO, Sarah. What we want to talk about here today is a general principle in public services that sometimes people call user pays. And what we mean by that is the general notion of if you provide a public service, the notion of assigning some or all of the cost of that service to the individual or the group of people who participate in that activity or receive the benefit of that service. Basically, if you use it, you pay for it. And in my mind, this is sort of an interesting general tension between having services paid for by the greater populace on behalf of everybody versus services paid for by the beneficiaries and more direct recipients. So that's what we want to get into. We're going to walk through a few different examples, some of them with applications specific in Maryland, some of them are which are bigger, broader, sort of textbook sort of things. And a lot of this does connect to your portfolio, Sarah.
Yeah.
Things you cover for MACO, including like public health, public safety. A lot of the most interesting case studies in the user pays concept are in your areas, right?
Yeah, interesting is definitely a way of looking at it. I mean, like you already said, you know, it comes up in a ton of areas such as parks and licensing and permitting and stuff. But I think what might be unique about my areas with public health and public safety is that that's when the conversation in these categories really starts to focus on like fairness and like equity and access to government services. And I think for that reason has a tendency to be considered slightly more controversial when it comes up in these categories, for sure, some might say.
Yeah. So I mean, I don't think this is a settled matter. So there's a little bit of controversy and back and forth in this as a matter of policy, but that's why it's interesting to talk about. Loyal listeners know I love my tension. I love when there are two legitimate sides to an argument that exists at the same time and you kind of have to wrestle with both of them. And I think that's what we're going to steer toward as we talk about this today. So what do we want to get into today?
Yeah, I mean, well, the only other thing I would add to that is just, you know, these are things that we've been seeing a lot more in recent years from, you know, just some of the complications around the Great Recession, sort of the fee for services have been used as a way to supplement the cost of certain services rather than cutting valuable programs that benefit communities. But this concept is not new generally. I mean, you know, across the world, like I know economists have made suggestions to developing governments where, you know, they're saying a way to stabilize and apply more longevity to the programs you're starting to establish, user fees can help do that. And so it's definitely a concept that's been broad and out there globally for a while.
Right. So this idea has its proponents and its adherents. So let's like kick off with the broad sort of title question. If we set a policy that the user pays for the services that she consumes, is that good policy?
Oh, it just depends. You know how we always want to say it depends and just get into all the details of this. But I think as we go through some of the examples, you'll start to see why that answer is not going to be straightforward all the time.
Right. So this, I mean, to spoiler this for everybody, we're not going to wind our way through this podcast. And at the end, we're going to spike the football and say one side wins. It's over. User fees are fantastic, or user fees are the devil. Instead, the answer is kind of a more nuanced. It depends on the circumstance. It depends on the kind of service. And maybe it's more like, let's talk about the lens that one should use to evaluate whether a user pays concept makes sense for a particular kind of service. Because I think the things we're going to talk about over the course of this podcast will be kind of all over the map.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the first ones that we discussed previously was immunizations, and those are something that are considered, I think for the sake of this conversation, let's consider them a pure public good and something that, you know, there can be a fee associated with getting an immunization, but that requirement is something that is seen as valuable for everyone's, you know, health and safety. So that's another one that's out there.
Right. So I think like in a public affairs textbook at an institution of higher education, where students are studying this sort of stuff in a, you know, nose in the book manner, I think immunizations is sort of the easiest to get your head around. The notion of, should you charge somebody, you know, $150 to get a shot so that they won't, so that they're far less likely to come down with a communicable disease, right? Something like measles. Mm-hmm. And forgive me for the aside, but I mean, I get that maybe at the moment there's sort of a dust up over vaccinations and where they fit in public policy and that sort of stuff. And I mean, it's sad to even have to make this conversation, but like for our discussion, let's pause it. We're talking about safe, effective shots that keep people from getting a serious illness that they might otherwise spread to other people in the community, right? So like measles. And
exactly.
Generally speaking, almost everybody would say that, okay, the measles vaccine and getting kids and adults and everybody vaccinated against measles is a really good idea and we all benefit from it.
And that's one end of it. And then you've also got, you know, things like vehicle registration. That's on the exact opposite end of it. And it's like, that's not something where everybody is going to elect to have a vehicle and need to register it and get their driver's license.
Right, right. So, okay. So there's maybe part of developing this, like a framework for saying what are good candidates and what are not. So I guess the underlying theory with vaccinations as being something different from a vehicle registration is, if I buy a car and register my car and I want to drive on the public roads, I go to the government and register it to do so, or I get a driver's license to do so, I'm the one person who benefits from that, right? Yeah. So that's fundamentally different from a vaccination program where we don't want to make sure that all the kids have gotten shots so that we won't have measles running around in the community risking everybody. And so there's a societal benefit to the public good in a way that there may not be for a more private or more individual benefit. And that's where, boy, it would be silly to charge a fully cost-capturing fee for every vaccination that might have the effect of telling people, of some people saying, I can't afford it, I'm not going to go get the shot.
Yeah, definitely. And I think you're also starting to get into a little bit, you know, when we're talking about something extremely broad that affects everybody, is sort of that conflict between whether or not this is something that should be covered in our taxes, or if they're is a fee that should be charged separate from our taxes to cover these types of things.
Right. So I think that's true as well. And it's probably another indicator of whether something is truly a limited benefit item that would make more sense for a user pays philosophy. Right. So if this is something that virtually everybody should do or needs to do, or practically speaking has to do, then okay, as a fee or as a tax, maybe there's a different argument there.
Yeah. Well, and this is definitely an argument that, I mean, I know in some states, there have been court cases that have gone back and forth over whether or not the fee was constitutional. I read something in Oklahoma one time where their Supreme Court recently eliminated a fee that was a requirement. Mm-hmm. And I think it actually turned out that it was because those funds were being used in it. One, it, the cost, what they were taking in the fine or the fee, I think it was more than the cost of whatever the service was. So there was more money than they needed to run the program, and it was going into a general fund. And then that mm-hmm. was considered a tax, not a fee. And so right. It was the wrong mechanism for a tax. And then, you know, they struck it down as unconstitutional in their state.
Right. I think that philosophy has been applied at different levels of governance for a pretty long time. The idea of, if you're going to charge someone a fee or a permit application or something along those lines, there needs to be a nexus between what you pay and what those dollars pay for. So exactly. Like that case in Oklahoma, I presume that the outcome was basically you can't effectively use fees and charges to just support general costs of government. They need to be attached to the actual service rendered in exchange for the fee. If you can't get a permit until you pay the fee, then that fee should be connected to what it costs to do the inspections mm-hmm. or do the evaluations that go into granting the permit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when, you know, even just legislation that I was looking at from this past session, there are so many bills where when we're looking at taking in a fee for something, I think a lot of the ones I saw were speed cameras. There are line by line specifications that this cannot go into the general fund. This must be used for public safety. What just basically, I think, safeguards for what you see in Oklahoma.
Right. So now what we're doing is we're sort of adding a little flesh to the bones of this conversation. Mm-hmm. If you start with a one sentence, it might sound pretty appealing, especially to the sort of clinical economist who lives in an academic building and doesn't actually see the real world. It may sound appealing to say, take pressure off general taxes by using a variety of fees and charges so that the direct beneficiaries of a service actually pay their fair share or shoulder the load for those services, make the users the ones who are responsible.
And I've even read that making sure one of the best practices is making sure that whatever that specific user group is that it has to be less than half of the general population.
Okay.
Like, so there are these best practices for it.
Right. So maybe some rules of thumb on the notion of once your beneficiary group is enormous, then it's probably sensible to at least consider broad taxation as a universal service, because if the definition of the group benefiting is so broad as to include virtually everybody, you know, half, two thirds, three quarters, nine tenths of the population, then at that point, it's basically a universal service and that niche argument is lessened.
Yeah. But another thing that we're seeing, you know, when you look at some of that, the more broad stuff, and I actually saw this with a bill that I was looking at during session as well in Maryland, is sort of this assessed, like if you do have a broad fee, you apply it based on an assessment of the individual's ability to pay. And that's actually been enacted in a few, I want to say it was three or four states that I had read about. But we saw a bill where basically the fine for, I think it was a particular speed camera violation, would be assessed on a sliding scale based on income levels, not including assets. So that's out there. I mean, that's definitely something that's being explored.
Right. So let's try and lay out some of these ideas that are sort of bumps in the road, if you will, for the idea of saying we're intrigued by the idea of user pays. And we got a few different principles. One is illustrated by vaccines. One principle might be if the use of the service or the recipient of the service is something we want to have as broad as possible, applying fees, not just that universality issue, but also applying a fee may reduce participation and that may be undesirable. So
That's
you don't want
like
people to say no to vaccines, or I'm not going to use my public library, or I'm not going to get that educational opportunity or whatever because it costs too much for me. And I think an extension of that is also sort of a fairness matter. And I think these are adjacent, but they're similar issues. So the idea of if a fee or a charge amounts to enough that it's a significant burden on people with different socioeconomic strata, if your economic ability, your ability to pay a $50 fee or a $200 fee or fine or something like that, we should consider societally, is it appropriate to charge everybody the same $200, right? And not right. everybody can handle $200 in exactly the same way.
Yeah. But then when you're also thinking about fairness, you know, you've got some of the user fee situations where they could maybe be considered elective. So I think we were talking about public parks. Is that what we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, I think public parks are another like really interesting example here. Right. Yeah.
And so that one's kind of a tough call. You know, I mean, you can charge a pass charge a fee for admission. But then, like you were saying before, you likely reduce the number of people who benefit from the recreational offerings there. Another example is if you want to take a paddleboarding lesson that is offered by local parks and rec, that might be something that there is a fee for. And so I think there are two ways of thinking about this. So some might say going to hang out at your local park and having to pay a fee is an elected experience. You know, you chose to do it. So maybe you pay a fee that helps cover the maintenance potentially. But then the other side might be that this is accounted for in your property taxes to live in the area where that park is. And then maybe there is a third way of looking at it, which is the third could be both activities seem to be elective, whether you want to do the paddleboarding lesson or just go to the park, which right. is very different than a user fee for, you know, something associated with a court issue or immunizations, let's say.
Right. And I think I think that array of services at a public park is like several interesting data points on this continuum between the pure public good or the universal everybody benefits from this service where a fee doesn't make any sense to the full opposite range of you absolutely should do a charge, right? And like yeah. I think I'm mostly persuaded that if I want to go take a class and learn how to do paddleboarding and they offer it at one of my public parks, then if $30 a head is what it takes so that 10 of us can take that course, like I think that makes plenty sense for me to yeah. chip in my $30 to be able to take that class. But at the same time, you know, the idea of charging for every visit to the park or to have a pass to go to the park, if that leaves some families out and they just don't get the benefits of that public recreation, these are open spaces. You can Definitely. Go and play games and you can see life in nature and you can have active recreation that's good for your health and mental health and so forth. Like mm-hmm. the list of reasons why having people go to the park in general is pretty compelling. To me, that inches closer to the side of the public good, where I Definitely. Want a lot of people to participate in public parks. I almost yeah, want that I feel to the be same way. Free or yeah. nominal, right?
Yeah, especially when you're thinking about, like, you know, some of the public parks have some really phenomenal things to offer. Like, I live in Anne Arundel County, and you have to pay to get into the gate, but behind that gate is a beach dog park. Like, I know people that come from Virginia to go to that beach dog park, right. but it's one of those things that's a great, awesome thing to have access to and great for like lifestyle and quality of life, but it's behind the fee per se.
Right. But it also, it's not like the Anne Arundel County or most governments, it's not like the county runs the entire park department just based on, I mean, I think in this county, it's $30 a year if you're a county resident to get a pass so you can use it all year long, or yeah. like $6 a car if you want to visit.
Yeah. But then another nuance is that there are some parks that they are more protected areas. There's one, I think it's called Waterworks Park here in Anne Arundel, where they have a lake in there that people can fish. But they're, in terms of that ecosystem, there's a lot of protection that needs to be happening for that particular body of water. And that, I believe, plays into the fee that you have to pay to go into that one.
Right.
So it's very nuanced.
Yeah. It is nuanced, but there are a variety of principles that make sense to consider as a policymaker ways, like how much should you use the user pays principle, relying mm-hmm. on fees and charges from the beneficiary. So
yeah.
I think this is interesting public policy. I know, like, you've, in covering this portfolio this last session, you've already made mention of bills and questions that have come up in legislative policy. I can tell you over the years, this is a pretty regular matter that policymakers in the state legislature, and I'm sure this happens on the ground in county government as well, are pretty routinely faced with this. Is this the appropriate area for a charge or for a fee
yeah.
as opposed to coming out of general taxes?
Yeah. And I think some of the parks example that we were just talking about, that's one, like I was talking about at the top, it's less controversial generally, because you can choose to go to a park or not. I think sometimes when we get into court fees and fees that, you know, come up from having some sort of interaction with the law, those I think are where you start getting into, they didn't necessarily elect to do that. Maybe it was a situation where you ended up having a dust up with the law over, you know, a crime of desperation that had to do with feeding your family. And so having fees in that instance, that's where you really start to see those conversations about fairness and equity.
Right. Okay. So I think that is a good transition to let's talk about the justice system. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted this to be a conversation that you and I could get through, because this is an area that you're working in on policy. So the justice system feels like one of those areas where you certainly don't want to deny people justice, right? You don't want to deny people a fair outcome. But yeah, we do see cases in the judicial system where you get assessed court costs. Like if you have a traffic accident, or like you mentioned, you end up in some sort of a dust up, whatever the cause, you may end up paying court costs that are levied by the courts nominally as a way to cover their own expenses for the various mm-hmm. staff and employees who are part of the judicial system. They, you know, they yeah. bring in and they pay jurors, but there are bailiffs and clerks and interpreters and the judges and law clerks, all these people who are part of the justice system. I know general taxes are part of funding the justice system in Maryland, but things like court costs and fees are part of that as well. So here we are in the same debate about, is it appropriate to assess the people being processed and going through the justice system with those extra costs? And it raises these same questions.
Yeah. And I think one of the things too that, you know, I've seen just in reading a little bit about this is when it comes to what you would charge a fee for, it oftentimes has to do with how much you are using the services of an individual person. Like, so the labor associated with your access to whatever that service is. And so if you're in the court system, because you would be working with a clerk or one of the lawyers, that's a situation where the best practice might say, yes, you would charge for that. But then you go back to what are the factors that led to that individual being in that situation, and if there's an equity question there.
So then you end up with a matter that's a complicating matter in this talking about the courts and the justice system, and that is... I don't know what the right word is here, but it's fairness, not economic fairness, but fairness of, you know, what about the person who didn't necessarily do anything seriously wrong and now is shouldered with extra costs, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that's, we talked a lot about that this past session with legislation that was talking about how to make court access more accessible. And there's a ton of research on this, but it's one of those things where, you know, you could have had just a minor traffic infraction, but, you know, if you are resource scarce and getting childcare or taking a day off work to show up for your court appearance, like if that's a tough thing for you to make happen and you miss your court appearance, or you don't have access to the online services that would help you change the date or whatever it is, like that, they didn't do anything that's that egregious. But if they miss their court date, or they don't have access to it because there is an electronic availability to do it remotely, then that can turn into other fees that get compounded when it wasn't even a serious situation. You weren't detained. And that's tricky, especially for resource scarce individuals.
Right. So like this is another potential outcome from weighing this idea of user pays and saying, let's rely on fees and charges for those who are involved in that service. In the judicial system, if you end up saying, well, let's assess court costs and let's assess fines, the notion of someone for whom a $200, $300, whatever charge is a seriously burdensome matter, and then that prevents him from getting to his job because you can't fix the car. Now you've got a compounded effect that, again, you end up with an undesirable outcome as a result of an overburdensome reliance on user fees.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think the other thing that we haven't really talked about yet is how much are those fees really contributing to the overall budget, let's say, for a county? And whether or not if you do away with those fees, how much how much revenue has to be replaced in that individual instance. And that's something that I know a lot of researchers are weighing.
Right. So in a lot of these cases that we're mentioning, where things have landed as a matter of policy equilibrium is a blend that you end up with some of the costs of various functions, like the parks. Yeah. In a county may charge an annual fee to be able to visit the parks, or a one-time fee to visit a park, but that's not 100% of the park's budget. It might cover 10 or 20 or 30% or something like that. There's a user fee component, but it's not exactly this service is fully supported by its beneficiaries.
Exactly.
So this ends up being a blended approach, sort of like a copay in medicine. Right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Right. So I think the issues with criminal justice are interesting, and it gets more complicated because the government's relationship with people, this isn't just providing a voluntary service. The idea of adjudicating matters of the law is more consequential, and it deals with people's liberty and so forth. So that's a little bit trickier. So
yeah, and socially or economically disadvantaged individuals or historically disenfranchised individuals. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely where it gets complicated.
Right. And it is in the courts where it's relatively common, and maybe this is getting a wider thing as well, the idea of waivers for indigents. So this is something you can see pretty frequently, that the judge will say court costs of $300 are suspended on account that this defendant probably can't afford the $300, and it might be an untoward burden on that person to place $300 in court costs, so we'll suspend them.
Yeah. And I mean, that's some of the infrastructure that I was talking about before that you've seen in some states, where you do have to add a new process and new people to operate that process and new technology for it. And so it's weighing those costs, I think.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then it also maybe suggests, as other user fees and charges, when they amount to a significant dollar amount where the economic impact might be material and the effect on different people with different capacity to pay might be meaningful, then maybe having some rounded edges. You provide an indigency exception, or you provide a scholarship sort of thing. Like, let's make available to kids in our schools who get a free or reduced price lunch, let's give them all a free pass to the public parks as a way to sort of get around what might be a concerning balance of contribution on those costs. Like, that's a way to address this in public policy, is to say, here's the general policy, but then these are going to be the exceptions or the tools to combat that.
Exactly. And I think typically with legislation and policy, it's hard to round those edges. And so that's sort of that delicate balance. It really just takes a lot of cooperation, collaboration, and understanding of the nuances of the issues, which sometimes during legislative session, it's really difficult to do that unless a lot of groundwork has been laid before you get there.
Right. Okay. So I think where we get to by talking about several of these things is the question of whether fees and charges as a user pays philosophy is good policy or bad policy. Basically, it becomes a checklist of things to consider. And do you end up with depressing uses that have a greater beneficial societal benefit, you know, concept? Do you end up having a disparate impact on members of your community who have different abilities to afford the fees and charges? And sort of the universality of the service at some point betrays this idea of it's just a certain number of users, they should be the one who pays. When the number of users becomes almost the universe, then that argument kind of thins out. So
exactly. And then that's when I think, you know, what we're seeing with all these new fees that have come up after the Great Recession, and we're seeing court cases like what we saw in Oklahoma, is that there's a very fine line to walk there when it starts to get more broad, and whether or not it should be rolled into taxes or if it should be a separate fee.
Right. Okay. So I want to take this framework a little bit and then apply it to a topic that is in the news in Maryland right now. It's something that policymakers in Maryland are contemplating, and it may not be obvious to everyone that to some degree, this is kind of the user pays debate happening in real time. Not just Maryland, everybody's dealing with this, but what I'm talking about is the way we fund transportation, and in particular, thinking about roads and bridges. Maryland has a big universal transportation trust fund, but we'll skip that for the moment and just sort of think in terms of how do you pay for roads and bridges? When you build new roads, you maintain the ones that we have, you provide safety, upgrades and signage and all that kind of stuff on our public roadways. How do you take care of the public roadways? And for the most part, Maryland, like just about everybody, has had a philosophy, which is basically the users of the roads ought to pay for the roads. And for decades, that's been a relatively simple exercise of saying, we will apply a tax on motor fuel, on gasoline and diesel fuel and that kind of stuff.
Right, because that was universal to the driver.
Yeah, right. So even though the use of roads is relatively universal, we know that some people use the roads a lot more than others. And so that ends up being another component of the user pays concept. So rather than paying for roads and bridges principally out of something like the sales tax that everybody pays when you buy a pair of shoes, or the income tax that everybody pays when you just earn income, instead, you use a targeted tax source like a tax on gasoline and diesel fuel and say, for the most part, those are the people who are driving the vehicles that are wearing down the roads, so they need to be maintained, that are demanding more roadways that need to be built. And, you know, they're the ones that we need to keep safe with our highway patrol, all that kind of stuff. So that, in a broad sense, is kind of a practical application of the user pays philosophy, right?
Yeah.
So here's where we are now, that there is an unusual pivot in that conversation, that for years and years, you buy gas, that means you're on the road, you're using the highways, you should pay for the highway. But increasingly, the share of our vehicles on the road that don't use motor fuels or use a lot less traditional motor fuels and instead are powered by electricity or by other sources, suddenly, instead of being a trivial share of the vehicles on our roads, it's actually becoming a significant share, and everybody knows this is growing as a matter of.
So then there's the question of whether or not you add like a special tax to that. Like, I mean, then it starts to look like something like, what is it with cigarettes? Like the sin tax, like that's something that is specific to your electric vehicle.
So that becomes its own kind of challenging debate. If you want to stick with the concept of user pays and say, whomever is driving around on the highway and causing those roads to crumble and needs to be traffic policed and so forth, okay, you ought to contribute to those costs. So do we find a way to isolate the electric vehicles and non-motor fuel vehicles and assess them some sort of special charge? That would be the user pays philosophy. But yeah, like you said, that feels a little bit like, you know, like these, we call them an excise tax, or commonly people term them as a sin tax, right? And
yeah,
put those taxes on things that are societally less desirable. Mm-hmm. But most people are fans of electric vehicles, even if they're heavier and tear up the roads a little bit. Most people are fans of low emission electric vehicles as, you know, better for the climate. Generating electricity at a single source rather than lots of different combustion engines is lower overall output of climate disturbing outcomes. So like, that seems like good policy. Do you want to put a tax on that and reduce it?
Yeah, well, then you can look at it in the other direction. Is you're trying to find what you're just describing is sort of trying to find a way to isolate the individual that's this specific type of user. Let's say it's an electric vehicle, but then is there another way to go in the other direction and say, this is a commonality between gas powered, you know, vehicles and the electric vehicles where they can all be charged broadly? Like, maybe measuring how many miles their car has gone. So you can see specifically that these users are using it this much, but is that like super invasive?
Yeah. No, there's, so now you got another completely different question, but another interesting one. And that is, if you want to stick with the pay based on your miles on the road, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago, there wasn't any way to really know, I guess, other than the little, the odometer on your vehicle, you could come in and have somebody look at it every so often, but knowing how many miles you drove is kind of not the public's business, except nowadays with so many cameras and so many transponders and so forth, it's not far-fetched to think that you could. I mean, I know there have been tests in various places to say, okay, well, you traveled this many miles. So, this tiny fraction of a penny per mile is what you owe. Remit your check for, $104.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but that's the thing we've seen with a lot of different types of technology as they've advanced, is that when does it get to be too much in terms of how much you're monitoring people?
Right. Yeah.
How do you apply it in a way that's good?
Yeah. We've already got that question in Maryland law with things like, there's a camera at a toll booth that may take a photograph of your vehicle as you go through the toll booth, or there may be a speed camera that identifies your car. And there are things in Maryland law saying the information from those images can't be used for X, Y, and Z. Like, we don't want it brought up in your divorce proceedings that, you were driving to that place at that time.
Exactly. It's a public record.
Right. Yeah. this would raise all those same sort of issues. The idea of, in the pursuit of some sort of perfect user pays policy, you could track and measure everybody's vehicle miles traveled, exactly where and when and how many miles they traveled. But do we want to do that? Are there reasons to not do that that may trump whatever our interests are of having more precise data for assessing who pays for these public costs?
Yeah. Well, and I'd certainly say it is a question that is out there for a lot of different states right now when it comes to these. There's just tons of research, that can go all the way in one direction or all the way in the other in terms of finding examples that would justify one or the other. So it's definitely a hot topic for sure.
Yeah. And Maryland is in the middle of this one particular bit of it, that the tip of the spear here is electric vehicles that for the most part do not consume motor fuels. Therefore, they don't pay the motor fuel tax and they don't make the same kind of contribution toward the costs of fixing the roads they drive upon in the way that the other traditional motor fuel driven vehicles do. And that is a hole in the boat for public policy and for public financing of roads. And what to do about it gets into every one of the questions that we've been talking about here. So we don't know what Maryland is going to do. There's a blue ribbon commission convened for this interim to spend time looking at transportation financing. And this is one of the issues they've got on their plate. But this whole framing of the user pays philosophy versus everybody pays through general taxes is an important way to think about public policy and financing services, because it matters in lots of ways for justice, for fairness, and for assigning costs to benefits. And all of this stuff is both interesting and very much happening right now.
Yeah. And as this topic is coming up, we have now just given, if you want to really spend a lot of time ruminating on this, we've given the audience a lot of different angles to look at it from. So if you want a deep dive like us, here you are.
Yep. That's why you come to the Conduit Street podcast. So,
amen.
Okay. Well, Sarah, thanks very much for joining the conversation. This covered the ground that I was interested in, and I appreciate some of the things that you dug into to add a little more flavor on beyond just this bill in Maryland or this thing that we've seen at MACO. So appreciate all that. Good conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Friends, let's wrap this up for this walk down Conduit Street. As always, if you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe. That way, all these episodes will be delivered directly to the device of your choice. And go ahead, smash that 5-star review. That's the best way to let your friends know that they should be listening as well. You can follow us on social media through Facebook, Twitter? Are we doing Twitter? I don't know. And of course, the Conduit Street blog. So for Sarah Sample, I'm Michael Sanderson, and we will talk to you soon.